Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. In Republican-controlled state legislatures across the country, moves are being made to change the nature of public education. It's happening here, too, which led Democratic Governor Roy Cooper to say something unusual.
It's time to declare a state of emergency for public education in North Carolina.
And like his road trip speaking with North Carolinians about the Republican abortion bill, he's embarking on a similar trip, which will bring him to Charlotte today to talk about what he sees as plans churning in the General Assembly that would irrevocably harm the public schools.
It's clear that the Republican legislature is aiming to choke the life out of public education. I'm declaring this state of emergency because you need to know what's happening. If you care about public schools in North Carolina, it's time to take immediate action and tell them to stop the damage that will set back our schools for a generation.
That sounds alarming. Is there cause for alarm, or is this political hyperbole? Well, this hour, we look at some of the plans ruminating in the legislature and hear more of how Governor Cooper describes those maneuvers. We're joined by WFAE education reporter Ann Doss Helms. Good morning to you.
Good morning. Coming fresh off a long CMS board meeting.
So
plunging right into Raleigh.
So I hear. Dr. Chris Cooper is a political scientist at Western Carolina University. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me on.
You're welcome. And Laura Leslie is Capitol Bureau Chief at WRAL-TV in Raleigh. Thank you for joining us again, Laura. Welcome back.
Thank you for the invite.
You're welcome. So, Ann, is this hyperbole or are the governor's concerns justified from what you're hearing as you cover the schools in this area?
As usual, the answer is both. Yes, it is hyperbole. I mean, this was 5.5 minutes of just all the strongest rhetorical terms he could muster. You could tell he went to his speechwriters and said, pull out all the stops, you know, give us everything. It was an atom bomb. It was choking the life out of the system. You know, it's a choosing corporations over classrooms, using political hacks for the Board of Education. And these are very real issues, I think. And you and I, the panels, have talked a lot on this show about the voucher bill in particular and how it is a real change of philosophy. And by the way, the hyperbole is just as strong on the other side. When I tweeted that this show was coming up and invited people to comment, a lot of it is not printable on the air. People had some strong things to say about what they thought about Governor Cooper. Fascism was among them. On the other side, you hear talk about putting students over systems. You know, public education is now a system and a bureaucracy. You hear about empowering parents and choosing your school, choosing your future. But this idea that, you know, that public schools are not the pathway to equal opportunity, but are one thing that's out there in the market, is a fundamental change of philosophy.
So tomorrow's program, we have an etymologist on to define fascism. What has been the reaction to the governor's recent remarks, Laura, from the legislators? Will it have any influence on them at all, or given their supermajority, do they really care what he thinks?
Well, a lot of them are just calling this a publicity stunt, which, I mean, in fairness, it kind of is. But that's what he's got to work with right now, because as you noted, with the supermajority, there's not much he can do to influence what happens at the legislature. One thing he can influence is getting people to call their lawmakers and tell their lawmakers, or email or whatever, you know, and weigh in on certain aspects of the education funding. And that's really about the only tool he's got in his toolbox right now. So, you know, these publicity tours that he's doing, both, as you pointed out, for abortion a couple weeks ago, and then for this subject this week, you know, this is him using what he's got to work with.
Yeah. And The Observer this morning has an editorial, Chris, that essentially is repeating an editorial they wrote a long time ago, saying it's about time he did something and now he's finally doing it. But there's very little that he can do, even in the best of times. And for him, I think this might be called the worst of times. Would that be accurate?
Yeah, that's absolutely accurate. Look, we've had three constitutions in the state of North Carolina. There's some things that are different across them. One thing that's pretty constant is that we are a legislature first state. The governor just doesn't have a lot of power, right? We're the last state in the country to give the governor the veto power. And now, of course, Governor Cooper can't even really use that power. So I think, as Laura said very well, the only tool in his toolbox is the rhetorical tool, right? So a long time ago, people talked about the power of the presidency is really in the power to persuade. And I think we can take that same idea and apply it to the governor. The only power Governor Cooper really has right now legislatively is the power to persuade. He's doing the best he can to try to persuade.
So in that speech he made, I think it was on Monday, he talked about opportunity scholarships, the expansion of the plans for expanding those. He talked about the budget and how we fund education and the lack of funding. Every single Republican in the House and Senate, as I understand it, appears to be in favor of expanding these school vouchers. Laura, they have a supermajority. Is this road trip a waste of time?
I think it is necessarily a waste of time. And I think, you know, I think who he's really talking to here, I mean, obviously he's talking to the voters, but I think what he's really talking to is probably business and community leaders in people's districts, right? Because, you know, if he can make the case that this is going to be bad for the state's workforce in the future, which of course he did in his short address, you know, he might be able to get some leverage there with the folks who have a deep investment in whether or not the state's workforce is adequate in about 10 or 20 years. So I think probably, you know, he might be able to slow it down. I'm just not sure, given the fact that both the House and the Senate, as you noted, have passed this with unanimous support among the Republicans. You know, this looks like it may be a ship that's going to sail. It's a little different, though. I mean, I don't know that any state so far has exactly what we have or would have under this bill, you know, in terms of lack of accountability, for starters, you know, the fact that we don't really track how voucher students are performing, what they're learning in these private schools. There's almost no accountability for that. And I don't know offhand of any other states that have as much will to give out money and as little will to see if it's working.
And we're going to talk about that a little bit later on in the program. Here's how the governor on Monday described some of these potential moves in the legislature.
Their private school voucher scheme will pour your tax money into private schools that are unaccountable to the public and can decide which students they want to keep out. They want to expand private school vouchers so that anyone, even a millionaire, can get taxpayer money for their children's private academy tuition. When kids leave public schools for private school, the public schools lose hundreds of millions of dollars. And while they hand out private school vouchers to millionaires, they also want to give them large tax breaks too. This drops an atomic bomb on public education by shrinking the state's budget by almost 20%.
All of which we're going to talk about, but Anne, I think it bears a little moment to spend on what exactly opportunity scholarships are for those who don't follow education all that closely, and what the legislature is considering doing.
Right. So opportunity scholarships were created, I think, about a decade ago, and they were pitched as a way to give low to moderate income families an alternative to failing public schools. And so there was, and I don't have the amount on hand. I believe it started at about $4,200, which is not going to cover a high-end private school, but it's going to help you get into potentially a local school. And there was an income cap if you were above a certain level, and it was not a very low level. It was, you know, a middle income family could still get these, but only certain people could get these, and only if they were in a public school and wanted to move to a private school. So, and it was built in to expand the funding every year. You know, Laura kind of talked about giving out money without demanding results. They didn't care how many people signed up. They didn't care how the kids did. They weren't tracking how the kids did. It was just going to increase every year. So there was a lot of concern about that going in. But now these matching bills, which are titled Choose Your School, Choose Your Future, are saying it's open to everybody. Now, you do get more if you're lower income than you would if you're that millionaire who's, you know, getting a little money to help you pay your $25,000, $30,000 a year high-end tuition. But you can get that chunk of money. And it, you no longer, you know, if my kid has been at Providence Day School since kindergarten and they're now in sixth grade, I can apply and say, I'd like my little chunk of backpack funding, one of the other new rhetorical terms that's out there. I'd like to carry my piece of tax funding with me to my private school. So this has sort of a double impact. One is that this is a large chunk of money that is being spent on private schools that in theory could in fact go toward public school teacher salaries or whatever. And if kids actually do choose to leave public schools and enrollment goes down, they will lose funding for teacher positions. And that
how concerned are administrators of the public schools, not just CMS, but Union County, Cabarrus County, et cetera? How concerned are they about this? Because if this passes, and it likely will, and it will likely be signed into law because they'll override the governor's veto on this, this could set off an exodus.
It could. And I don't actually have like quotes from local administrators because it's budget season. So they're all kind of focused on what they can control, which is, you know, their pitches to county commissioners, doing as much as they can with local funding. CMS has been a little bit occupied with a superintendent search, but they know this is coming. I don't think they like it. What I'm really interested in, I think, is the red counties that surround us, because I think Governor Cooper could inspire everybody in Mecklenburg County to, you know, email Phil Berger. He doesn't care. You do wonder at a certain point, if a lot of the Republican legislators start getting pressure, will things change?
Dr. Cooper, the public schools, under most metrics, have stood the test of time. They've done us well. They have put out generation after generation after generation after generation of people who have gone on to be successful, who have gone on to higher education, who have gone on to high-paying jobs, etc. In the last 25 or 30 years, however, we've been hearing the term failed or failing public schools. The question is are they failing, or is that just a political boogeyman? And if so, why? What is the slant against public education politically?
That's me the easy ones, don't you, Mike?
You
know, I'd say, first of all, I think let's remember that the battle against public schools and the battle over public schools is older than just the last 20 or so years, right? I mean, really, what are conversations about busing that were, of course, centered around the city of Charlotte and Mecklenburg County, but those are very much about what people thought public schools should be. Banning books has a very, very long history. What people should have access to in the schools has a long history in this country. So it's a great way to control the state, right? If you can control the youth, and that, I think, has been a consistent political fault line in our state.
Well, you brought up busing, and busing indicates integration. And is that the crux of this? Racism?
I do not think it is the crux of it, but I don't think it is possible to untangle conversations about race from conversations about public education, right? Or really most things in North Carolina politics. But grab a county near me, like Graham County, there are nine registered African-American voters in Graham County. Like, you can count them on both hands and you still have a thumb left over. They're having many of the same conversations about public and private schools. And those are not, those feel, I think, very differently in terms of race than the conversations happening in Durham. So I think we need to remember this is a blunt instrument that applies to the whole state, and it is a very diverse state. That doesn't mean that the whole state is diverse. That means that some counties are very homogenous and other counties very heterogeneous. Race matters. Certainly, if you were to ask Trisha Cotham, you were to ask any of the sponsors, they would say race has nothing to do with this. But clearly the history of North Carolina politics, the history of public policy in our state is intertwined with race in ways that you cannot deny.
And you mentioned Trish Cotham, her defection from the Democratic to the Republican Party several weeks ago. She's from Mecklenburg County, is one of the reasons that the governor has less power this month than he did last month, which means he will not be able to override or veto this bill successfully. We're going to come back and talk about the cost and the impact of all of this and what some other Democrats are saying about the Opportunity Scholarship Expansion Program when we come back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the fact that Governor Roy Cooper declared a public education state of emergency on Monday, and he is touring the state with that message. He'll be in Charlotte today at, I think, 12:15 at Huntingtown Farms Elementary School to tour the school and also to get his message out about how he feels we need to protect public education. And Doss Helms, WFAE's education reporter, is with us, along with Laura Leslie, Capitol Bureau Chief at WRAL-TV, and Dr. Chris Cooper, Professor of Political Science at Western Carolina University. The governor is not alone among the Democrats in the legislature, etc., sounding the alarm about this. Wake County Democrat Julie Von Hafen says Republicans are pushing the most radical defunding of public education we have ever seen in this state. She's talking there about the budget. And her colleague, Democratic State Senator Rachel Hunt, says the expansion of opportunity scholarships shows us something else.
They have shown us who they are and what they value. They are anti-public education, they are anti-teacher, and they are anti-student.
Within the legislature, Laura, where did the idea for expanding these opportunity scholarships originate? Is it within this body, or is it coming from without? Are they copying what's being done in other states, or is this something from that organization called ALEC that we'll talk about later?
Well, I think there's a lot of impetus for this from different corners. But, you know, when this started, it was back in, I think, 2013. I don't know if I'm right, Anne, you might be able to tell me. But, you know, initially, as Anne said, it was very limited to, you know, lower income folks. They've been expanding it over the years to raise the income cap so that more and more people would be eligible for it, because they weren't getting enough interest in it. Right. So that was, for a long time, was the argument against expanding it. But I think they, you know, I think they think by sort of blowing it wide open, obviously, this sort of is the logical endpoint of where they started this to go, to say, you know, that every child has a certain amount of money, as Anne was calling it, backpack money is a term they use. And that child should be able to take that funding portably with them wherever their parents want to send them to school. Obviously, that is a very different way to look at education funding than the state's ever looked at it before.
There seems to be a lot of stuff going on in the legislature, much of it at breathtaking speed, which is unusual for any deliberative body. Is that simply because what's causing the urgency of the moment here? Simply because now, all of a sudden, they have the supermajority? Is that it?
That's a big part of it, yeah. I mean, they have it, you know, and they've got a lot of stuff that they've been sitting on for 4 years when Cooper had the veto that they knew they weren't going to be able to get through. But now they're, you know, they see a light at the end of the tunnel. They're like, well, we can get this stuff passed, you know, and there are some really big proposals here. I mean, you know, if you go, I mean, not to change the subject away from vouchers, but one of the proposals would be a constitutional amendment that would have the voters elect the members of the Board of Education, right? Right now, those are appointees from the governor and mostly, and the governor and the legislature, but and some ex officio members. But this would make them sort of like by congressional district. It would be very, very political to do that. And it would highly politicize the Board of Elections. And that's what he was talking about, political hacks. I mean, I don't know if they'd be hacks or not, but nonetheless, it would be a far more political place than it is. And it is already pretty political.
An Office of State Budget and Management Analysis released prior to the vote, the 65-45 vote in the House on this bill for expanding vouchers, estimates that public schools would lose thousands of students to the private schools, costing the public schools more than $200 million a year by the 2026-27 school year, which is just around the corner. When you spread that out statewide, what would you expect the impact to be to most public schools, Anne?
Well, this is, again, from that same analysis that you're referring to. It's very interesting. There are obviously a lot of assumptions in there because you just don't know for sure who's going to get a scholarship. Are they going to be existing private school students? Are they going to be people leaving the public schools? But I think they started with the number of opportunity scholarship recipients now, projected out a couple of years, and assumed that half of them would be people leaving the public schools. And I had sort of thought that the bigger impact might be in the counties like Mecklenburg, where we have a wide array of private schools at a large array of price points. But the biggest percentage impacts they found were often in the smaller counties, which is interesting to me. I don't know if they have more public or private schools, or if some are springing up right at this price point to say, hey, get your kids out of public schools. But Gaston was among one of the ones seeing bigger impacts.
I think it's because those counties have fewer students. And so each student makes up a larger share of the money that they, their pupil funding that that school system gets from the state. So when you start taking a student or two or 10 or 20 out of Mecklenburg, I mean, that's, you know, a drop in the bucket. But when you're talking about having 30, 40 kids go out of a school in, say, Graham County, that's a big hit to them.
So Governor Cooper has predicted a dire outcome for public schools if vouchers for all come to pass.
Public school superintendents are telling me they'll likely have to cut schools to the bone, eliminate early college, AP and gifted courses, art, music, sports, if the legislature keeps draining funds to pay for private schools and those massive tax breaks.
What tax breaks, Laura, is he talking about?
This is a Senate proposal to cut taxes, cut the income tax pretty radically. It's already scheduled to go down gradually over the next few years. What the Senate plan would do would be to accelerate that. So essentially, your income tax right now, I think, is like 4.99 or 4.75 this year. It would go down to 2.5 by the year 2030. Now, the Republicans say that they believe that there is enough growth in the state that the growth will keep the revenue coming even at a lower rate. And they also say, well, if it doesn't, you know, we have this massive $5 billion rainy day fund to back it up. But of course, that's finite money. And one-time money, as they like to point out, can't really be used for salaries. You know, in the meantime, it's, you know, unclear, certainly. I mean, we've certainly had a great growth trend in North Carolina over the last decade, but no trend lasts forever. So, you know, the question is how low they want to go before this starts to get to be a real problem for the state's coffers.
So the governor says public school superintendents say they will likely have to cut AP and gifted courses, art, music, and sports. Very quickly, Ann, is that what you're hearing from any administrator anywhere?
I have not heard that, but I have not specifically asked them.
And Chris, if that turns out to be the case, will that be politically popular?
Certainly not. I mean, but I think it's also a very political, strategic list of things that could be cut. Like if you said, I'm going to try to reach out to suburban voters in some of these swing districts, what would be the things you would list? I think you just named them.
Okay.
And it's worth noting that this is playing out also as the federal COVID funding is getting ready to go away. There was kind of this massive influx of federal money, which is usually a pretty small part of school districts' operating budgets in North Carolina. It funded all sorts of things, teacher retention bonuses, you know, additional staff. And in about a year, that's going to be gone. So this, I think there is probably some very real anxiety among school districts. It's just not the task that's on today's to-do list for most
right.
of them.
If large number of students end up abandoning public schools, would that mean that only those who can't afford a private education, even with the vouchers? And that's part of the problem here, is that the high end, the high dollar earners who have kids already in these private schools would be eligible to get some money for these in these vouchers, and the low end are not going to get enough money to pay for most private schools. So they'll end up staying, one would think, in the public schools. They'll be left behind. So those would be the people in the public school seats, along with those people who perhaps have parents who are disconnected and don't care about this at all. What would that mean over time? The money being sent to public schools would by necessity be reduced. So what would it mean for those left in those schools?
Well, I want to add, I mean, okay. You were asking about the list that Cooper put out, and I agree with Chris that, yes, it is a politically carefully constructed list of things that will make suburban people upset. However, there is history, there is precedent for this, right? Back when we had the recession in 2009, 2010, and they started cutting funding for schools to get the budget in order, you know, those were the things that got cut, you know, music classes, art classes. It's taken till just the past few years to even get some of those electives back in some of these school districts, especially in the counties that don't have a lot of extra money to put in on top of what the state gives them. So I'm just going to say, as devil's advocate, some of that may actually come to pass.
I think much of it may come to pass. I think a lot could come to pass, and which ones he chooses to talk about is the strategic part. I'm not trying to argue at all that there's not some reality here. I think there is.
Certainly. And it's kind of hard to imagine that the legislature would let early college high schools go away. I think that whole, you know, getting kids prepared for college and or careers is very popular with both parties. So I don't know if there would be ways to say, well, we'll provide state funding only for this. Again, because another theme here that Governor Cooper talked about and that we're all very aware of is the state taking a much heavier hand in deciding not just how much is available, but how public school systems operate.
But if you take money away from the public schools and give it to individual, because the whole idea here is to stop funding systems and fund individuals, this backpack thing. So if you take money away from the public schools to give it to individuals to use vouchers to go to private schools of their choice, the public schools have to stay open by law. But if they're underfunded, what happens to the kids in those seats, in those schools that have had money disappear? Anne?
It's a very vicious cycle, I think, in that, and you already see that playing out to some degree. You know, people already have choices based on their means, whether it is to enroll in one of these high-end private schools or whether it's to move into a neighborhood where the test scores are high and there are all these wonderful options and a powerhouse PTA. So there is already a risk that public schools are sort of the they have to take everybody. And if I'm a private school, I can say, other languages. No, we don't have special education services. We don't have busing. You got to drive your kid here. We don't have public meals. You got to pay for meals. All these, and you can literally just say, you know, we have testing and screening. We're only taking the best students. So look at these wonderful, successful schools over here. There's also no rating system. So I can tell you that, you know, Ann Helms public school that I created yesterday is wonderful and amazing. It is up to the parents. That is their system of accountability for private schools is if you choose to come, good for you. Meanwhile, we have public schools serving an increasingly disadvantaged population, and there has been no move to eliminate or even revise these letter grades that already stigmatize high poverty schools serving Black and Brown students. So you're going to have an F school over here and you're going to have, you know, private academy over here. It could create a really bad cycle.
So Chris, yeah, I want to get, go ahead.
Sorry. I was just going to say one thing that, you know, that is sort of a fallacy behind the backpack funding idea is this idea that every kid uses every dollar that they're given by the state, right? I mean, there's a certain economy of scale, and that's what allows these schools to pay for a librarian, to pay for an art teacher, right? And so when you start removing those dollars from those schools, then any ability to pay for those extra things that the state doesn't directly pay for, that's what really gets cut into.
So, Chris, I want to get back to what this is really all about. And I ask that because years ago, a former CMS school board chair pulled me aside after one of our programs and told me off the record to look into ALEC. ALEC is the American Legislative Exchange Council. He said, look into them and the ideas they are circulating on the right. That former superintendent believed, and this was at least a decade ago, that they were pushing for the end of public education as we know it. And now, in Republican-controlled legislatures around the country, these moves are being made, including in Raleigh. So the other side, the Republican side, will tell you that they're trying to improve education by improving student choice and giving parents the freedom to educate their children the way they see fit. But in the process, why don't they just fix? Why don't they just fix public education? Or are they trying to really give that choice? Or are they trying to destroy public education? What do you think?
I truly don't believe. I mean, motives are hard to get to. I don't think they would say that they're trying to ruin public education or kill public education. But your statement from the CMS board member, in public education as we know it, I have a feeling if you had every member of the majority right now, the General Assembly, and said, would you like to end public education as we know it? They would probably say yes. I mean, I don't think they're hiding the ball here. I think they believe that our public schools are broken. They believe that the best way to fix it is to give people the chance to opt out. But I think the question about who is able to make this choice is so key. And Anne mentioned transportation. I just want to focus on that real briefly. So I live in Jackson County, pretty rural county. If there is a private school that springs up, which I think is very likely to happen after this, we have no public transportation. There is one taxi cab, the Freedom Taxi, that you can get in town, and that is it. So if you want to be able to get your kid over the mountain to that school, the lack of public transportation is going to fundamentally change who can and who cannot enroll in those schools. So I would think the Republican majority would say, no, we are not trying to kill public education. We're trying to provide better public education, a suite of choices. The response, of course, is who has access to those choices in reality.
And Anne, are private schools capable of handling whatever influx of students might result from this?
Well, again, that sort of gets to the market in each county. There's not an influx of students into, say, the big high prestige demand ones because they're already full. They already have waiting lists and they don't have to take anybody. So, yes, you could find yourself in a situation where you have a voucher but nowhere to go. You may also see some springing up that are specifically tailored to getting a lot of public money and providing, you know, is it going to be a great education? I have my doubts. And I just wanted to jump in on this, what you talked about, the motivations. I think there's a whole spectrum among legislators and among advocacy groups, but there is very much a national movement, some of which is pretty strong over there on disparaging public education. I didn't know about the Education Freedom Center until I got a press release this yesterday evening about Governor Cooper's state of emergency. And this, the director of that center also has a host called Student, or hosts a podcast called Students Over Systems, which again is that buzzword that you're going to hear over and over again across the country, Students Over Systems. And she described it, she said, it is cruel of Governor Roy Cooper to declare a state of emergency so that he can force North Carolina children to attend residentially assigned government schools. Now, that is not representative of every legislator in North Carolina, but that is part of that movement. And that, you know, that kind of sounds like kids are being sent to prison instead of a good neighborhood school.
This expansion of vouchers would give low-income families up to $7,000 a year toward private school of their choice. The wealthiest parents would receive more than $3,000. And even those parents who already have enrolled their child in a private school will now be eligible to get that money. How are lawmakers in 45 seconds or less, Laura, justifying giving wealthy parents whose kids are already in private schools vouchers?
It's the backpack money, right? Their child is entitled to the same amount of taxpayer funding to educate that the other child of a low-income family is, they say. So there's, you know, they are making some adjustment for that, obviously, by giving them less, but they say that that family is still entitled to that money because that child is entitled to the per pupil funding that would go with that child.
Okay, I want to come back to that because it seems to me there should be some metrics involved in deciding that, but we'll talk about that when we return with Laura Leslie from WRAL-TV, Chris Cooper from Western Carolina, and Ann Doss Helms from WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about Governor Cooper's road trip to declare a public education state of emergency. He's in Charlotte today. Ann Doss Helms is here from WFAE News. Laura Leslie from WRAL-TV, where she is Capitol Bureau Chief. And Chris Cooper, Dr. Chris Cooper from Western Carolina University. Some legislators have positioned this as an equity issue. They say that this expansion would allow more low-income students to break free of the bonds of public schools that may be failing them and allow them to flourish in a different environment. And there is a case to be made for that. But if that were the rationale, wouldn't the better course of action be to offer larger opportunity scholarships based on both need and student performance or some other metric so that low-income students could actually use those scholarships to attend a private school? Because this is not going to fund $7,700 is not, or $7,000 is not going to fund a private school education, Ann.
So what was the question?
Shouldn't it be a sliding scale based on need or student performance to say, yes, you could do better in a private school and it's going to cost you $16,000. Here's $16,000.
Yeah, there was a sliding scale. It's never been, you know, up to the full amount of tuition. And like you said, there are private schools that do very well with certain types of children. There are private schools that cater to, students of color, to disadvantaged students, to students with disabilities. All of those can be great options for students of all income levels. There has never been any kind of accountability other than, again, parent choice. And, you know, people move their kids in and out of all sorts of, sometimes people enroll their kids in a private school believing it's going to do wonders for their kid. If it doesn't, that child lands back at the public school, where the public school then has a lot of accountability. Philosophically, it almost seems to me like the Republicans ought to be saying, let's drop all school accountability. Let's just leave it up to the parents, you know, to figure out how they're doing and whether they feel good about a school. I don't think that would be smart. I'm not advocating that, but it's philosophically.
Well, if state money is being used to fund a child's private education, shouldn't there be strings attached? Couldn't they, as part of this law, say, if you take this money and use this money and a school accepts you with this money, they have to comply with these metrics?
Oh, they certainly could. Absolutely. They just won't. And it happened because there's a lot of these schools that are, you know, there's a lot of the high end ones, the ones that Anne's talking about that are great. There's a lot of them that aren't great. You know, and those are, a lot of them are going to be your smaller religious schools necessarily. And I mean, there's a lot of those schools that probably wouldn't necessarily meet the metrics.
And to be clear, what is the cost of an average private education per year? Do we know?
I do not know. It's got to be less than the $25,000.
It's certainly more than $7,000, exactly, unless you're right. going to a small, so, like, you know, kind of Christians or religious school that might give you a discount or, you know.
And so you're going to be less likely to see, I think, certified teachers, licensed teachers at those low cost private
schools. So given the fact that you can't afford to go to a private school on $7,000, what is this? I mean, is this just window dressing? Is this talking to the political base, Chris? I mean, what is this?
I mean, I think it will have an impact, like we've talked about. So I think it's more than just window dressing. I think this is policy that is intended to create change. This is a disruptive policy. I think they would argue that. And I think they're going to see disruption come. They're driving a conversation about public schools. I'm not arguing that they are correct, but I am arguing that they told us what they're going to do. They're doing it. And the notion of choice does brief well, right? If you just ask people on a public opinion poll, not to dig into the specifics of the policy, but do you want more school choice? People tend to say yes. And I think they are responding to that. I also think, as you pointed out before, Mike, this is a national movement, right? We talk a lot about the nationalization of state politics. And it's very much true here. In many of these education areas that we're talking about, you're seeing it across the country. And I think it's also part of another bigger trend, which is state governments versus local governments, right? We saw that on the bathroom bill. We're seeing that on a lot of these local bills. So the General Assembly under supermajority control, I expect to see try to get more power in the General Assembly away from local governments, whether those are schools, city councils, or county commissions.
It's also important to throw in the context that we're looking at right now in terms of education nationwide, right? I mean, schools are being demonized like we haven't seen in decades, right? They're woke, they are indoctrinating students, they are turning your students LGBTQ, they are CRT, you know, book bans, you know, people showing up, Proud Boys showing up at school board meetings. I mean, this whole sort of political temperature around public education has gotten really, really high over the past few years. And I think we have to see this in that context as well.
This idea of giving everybody money to fund their private school education is coming, Chris, from the same political party that is very much opposed to forgiving student debt. They call that socialism. What is this?
You know, this clearly, I think they would argue that it's not socialism. I think they would also probably draw, I mean, better right to have somebody from the majority making this case than me, but I think they would argue that K-12 education and higher ed are very different things, and that student loan debt for higher education is very different than giving people a voucher at the local level. I think they would argue that these are ultimately different policy decisions, but I think you're correct in pointing out that no party and no person is consistent in how much government interference they want. The reality is every one of us wants government in some parts of our lives. We don't want it in others. The real battle isn't over government control. It's about where you want it.
One of our listeners, Ernie, emails us, why hasn't the governor issued a state of emergency on improving the current education system, which is clearly broken? Too little, too late. And is it clearly broken?
Well, we know that North Carolina and pretty much every state in the United States does have these huge achievement gaps. I don't think there was a good old days when everybody was successful. I think we just started expecting public schools to help everybody be successful. And in fact, it makes a huge amount of difference, the advantages that you walk in the door with and the amount of support that you have from your home and your neighborhood and community. So yes, there are very low proficiency levels for not every student, but on average for Black students, Hispanic students, low-income students, students with disabilities. Yes. And I don't know that I've heard the governor use that label, state of emergency. Again, that sort of gets to that rhetoric of failing schools, but it is, everybody is aware that yes, there are big issues in helping all children succeed academically, and nobody's solved it.
I would also add that the governor has been calling for additional funding for public schools beyond what lawmakers have asked for since he came into office, excuse me. And we're still at the moment, we're somewhere in the bottom five of states for per pupil funding this year. So, you know, it's not a surprise that some students are going to be failed by schools if the schools are not adequately funded to address what those students need.
Is the problem, however, money, Anne, in all cases? Yes, the governor's been advocating for more money. The Leandro case was a court mandate for more money, which has been ignored for 20 years and which may not even be in play anymore, given the state of the Republican-controlled state Supreme Court. But is the problem money, or is it the fact that we've asked the public schools now for generations to solve societal problems, putting it all on their backs in addition to educating kids?
Yeah, I don't think there's a simple solution that if you just wrote a check of X amount, we know how to fix this. Sometimes you do hear that as political rhetoric. We know the solution, we just lack the will. But it is also true to say that you can't make real progress without money. You know, that if almost everybody would say really high quality principals and teachers and low enough staffing or low enough ratios that they can provide individual attention, all these support systems that you talked about, because we're asking them to do so much, all of those things are part of the solution. You aren't going to get that without good funding. And teacher raises are part of this dynamic. We haven't gotten into all the other things that the governor talked about, but he wants much more significant teacher raises, 18% over the next 2 years versus, I think, 7.5% in the House budget and 4.5% in the Senate budget. And, you know, you aren't going to get really great teachers and keep them if you don't pay them well.
Under the Senate plan, the senior teachers, anybody from 15 to 25 or 30 years would get $250. That is for a raise, right? I mean, that is something that the governor pointed out, and rightfully so. I mean, it's no wonder that we have problems with retention when you've got teachers looking at what's happening in the private sector, right? And wage inflation there, and they don't see any progress.
I want to skip to cut seven, Gabe. He's our producer this morning. Gabe is. So cut seven, because there are these two proposals in the General Assembly to address teacher raises, and one from the governor. And our teachers make, on average, I think, $12,000 a year below the national average. The governor's pay raise is the highest of the House and Senate and him. Of the three, he's offering more money. And he explained why during that press conference this week.
We have more than 5,000 teacher vacancies in kindergarten through 12th grade classrooms, leaving tens of thousands of students without a qualified educator. Our students deserve good teachers. That's why instead of tax breaks for rich folks and private school vouchers, I proposed a pay raise of 18% over the next 2 years, because our teachers deserve better pay and more respect. But the legislature wants to give them neither one. In fact, the Senate has given veteran teachers a $250 raise spread over 2 years.
That seems insulting on the face of it, or I don't know which is the more accurate term. But is it not true that the legislature has gradually, over the last several years, increased teacher pay, added salary bonuses and pay raises over the last couple of years? Of course, we were working from an extreme deficit. Is the governor just saying it's not enough and not quick enough, Laura?
Basically, yes. I mean, yes, we have increased, and the Republicans will point that out. You know, education funding has increased every year. It has to. because that we have more children and we're, you know, constitutionally required to educate them. Teacher salaries have gone up, but they have not kept pace with what's happened in other states. So that's why, even though we have little raises, 3% this year, 7% next year, we're still lagging so far behind the national average. And you may remember back in the 1990s, there was a big push by Governor Jim Hunt at the time to push our, to get our teachers up to the national average. And that took a lot of political will, even with the Democrats in charge, right? That's a big chunk of money to do that. And, you know, this is what he's calling for, is something along those lines. And it doesn't look like it's going to go anywhere.
And the raises have not always kept pace with inflation. You know, as we've heard often, a teacher in Charlotte cannot afford to get housing in Charlotte.
Right. According to a tweet from the Working Families Party, whatever that is, Chris, the median pay of teachers in the state is almost $20,000 lower than the median worker with an advanced degree, despite the fact that most teachers have a master's degree. When Democrats controlled the legislature, was that also the situation?
To some degree, yes. To some degree, no. So we've gone back and forth on giving raises for master's degrees, master's degree pay. And so that has vacillated over the years. Things were not perfect. I think, as Ann points out, when the Democrats were in control, certainly we were not drinking pretty bubble up and eating that rainbow stew.
Okay. In his recent press conference on Monday, talking about this road trip that he's taking that brings him to Charlotte today, and about his opposition to the legislative moves on education, the governor referenced the GOP culture wars, which are breaking out around the country and for which schools are, in fact, becoming a battleground, which you referred to a moment ago, Chris.
The Republicans in the legislature also want to bring their political culture wars into the classrooms. If they get their way, our state board of education will be replaced by political hacks who can dictate what is taught and not taught in our public schools. North Carolina schools need rigorous science, reading, and math classes, not more politicians policing our children's curriculum with book bans, elimination of science courses, and more. Put together, these ideas spell disaster that requires emergency action. The North Carolina I know was built on support for public schools, and we can't let the legislature tear them down.
So we've witnessed activists making moves across the country to restrict how gender is being regarded, sexuality is being taught, even how history is being taught. Is this the next obvious step, Chris?
By this, you mean?
All these moves in the legislature, opportunity, yeah, scholarships, et cetera.
Yeah. I mean, to some degree, right? But this is, I think, it's coming from a lot of different directions. And I think it is possible that somebody could, for example, support vouchers, but not support partisan labels on boards of education. I think it's possible that somebody could not support vouchers, but would think that we should elect board members statewide. So I think that's one of the interesting political battles here is Governor Cooper is taking a whole lot of Republican proposals, putting them all in one basket and saying, oppose these. I mean, this is being pitched as a state of emergency, but really it's a call for lobbying, including links from his website directly to how to contact your legislator and essentially lobby them. And so I think, you know, there's probably a little bit more nuance here than either party is letting on. And I think the average North Carolinian probably doesn't really want partisan school board elections. I'm not sure what they believe about vouchers, honestly.
That is his message in this road trip and in that speech he made on Monday to call, contact, text, email, whatever, your state legislator and tell them you want strong public schools. I have 30 seconds left. The governor did a road trip for abortion. It had no impact. Will this, Chris?
In 2024, maybe, in terms of policymaking in the short run, no.
Unless there's some kind of big pushback from the business community, I don't see this happening yet.
Okay. Laura Leslie gets the last word. She's Capitol Bureau Chief at WRAL-TV. Dr. Chris Cooper is Professor of Political Science at Western Carolina University. And Ann Doss Helms is our education reporter here at WFAE News. Thank you all for the hour.
Celebrating 25 years on the air, Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Wendy Herkey. The senior producers are Gabe Altieri and Sarah D'Elia. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.